Since the March 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, the civilian death toll resulting from the conflict remains a topic rarely discussed by American politicians or corporate media. While the Pentagon has refused to provide an estimate of Iraqi casualties, other groups have used various methods to arrive at the numbers of Iraqis killed. Iraq Body Count states that up to 42,000 have lost their lives, while The Lancet, a respected British medical journal, reported that a study in 2004 found that over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died due to the U.S. invasion. The May 17th pronouncement of Representative John Murtha, Democrat of Pennsylvania, that U.S. Marines deliberately killed 15 unarmed Iraqi civilians in cold blood last November has momentarily refocused public attention on the little-discussed costs of the occupation. Murtha, an opponent of the war, said that a Pentagon investigation into a November 19th incident in the western Iraqi town of Haditha found that Marines had killed 15 or more Iraqi civilians execution style in their homes after one of their comrades was killed by a roadside bomb. Among the dead were four women and five children, including a three-year-old girl. The Pentagon says the probe is not yet complete and refused comment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Sifton, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, who takes a critical look at the Pentagon's credibility in investigating soldiers accused of brutalizing civilians. Sifton also comments on the UN Committee Against Torture's call for the closing of the U.S. Navy's detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Well, we'd already been following this case for some time. Time magazine was actually the magazine that managed to break the story open in March of this year. They went to Haditha, they interviewed hospital staff, they interviewed some of the survivors and the relatives of the dead, and put it back together. Basically, the Marines lied about the incident. Somebody lied. It's not clear at what level the lie took place, but somebody lied about the incident, because when it was originally reported, the story was something entirely different. It was a story about civilians getting killed by an IED, an improvised explosive device, when in fact all the dead had been killed by gunshot. And it later came to be known that they were killed by the Marines.
The initial information, which turned out to be wrong, was issued by the Pentagon itself, was it not?
It's possible that the Pentagon Public Affairs Office itself was misled by Marines down the chain. On the other hand, it's possible that they were part of the conspiracy to mislead journalists and they themselves knew the truth. It's too early to tell.
Do you feel that the U.S. military has acted responsibly in investigating this incident? I'm sure dozens and dozens of other incidents that we hear about from time to time about civilians in the theater of war in Iraq being killed due to negligence or purposefully.
Well, there's a lot of variation. Sometimes the investigations are good, but sometimes they're done pretty badly. And there's been a lot of examples of the Army Criminal Investigative Command sweeping cases under the rug. The Navy Criminal Investigative Service, which is responsible for this investigation, has a better record, but it remains to be seen whether this investigation will be thorough and complete. We're a little disappointed already at how slow it's going. These cases often take much longer than they should, and we'd like to see them move a little quicker.
What could be done from the point of view of your organization, Human Rights Watch? What should be done within the military, within the Pentagon, to limit these kinds of incidents? And you always hear the cry that war crimes and murder of civilians are an inevitable byproduct of war anywhere. But what could be done to limit it?
Well, they may be inevitable, but there's some control over whether you can lower the amount of atrocities which take place, because certainly a better criminal justice system in the military will yield a lower amount of atrocities. The question is whether the U.S. military has a sort of consistent, strong accountability mechanism, and the truth is it just doesn't. The U.S. military justice system is very good for punishing people for disciplinary infractions and things like that, but it's terrible at dealing with widespread abuse or scandal, and that's because it's not independent. Unlike district attorney's office and U.S. attorney's office at the federal level, military prosecutors really have no discretion. They make recommendations to the commanding officers, and commanding officers decide whether people are going to be charged or not. It's just not a recipe for consistent accountability. It's not a good recipe for preventing atrocities when troops feel like if they play their cards right, they can slip out from under the yoke of punishment. And that's why you don't see consistency in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I wanted to turn to a different subject here in the same general area, John Sifton, and that is an 11-page report was issued by the United Nations Commission Against Torture, a panel of 10 independent experts on adherence to the UN Convention Against Torture, of which the United States is a signatory. And they have called on the United States, on the Bush administration, for a closure of the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, naval base. Tell us a little bit about this.
The truth is the Bush administration has tried to sell a bunch of really bogus legal theories to the committee and to the world at large. One of them is that they're allowed to hold people indefinitely and incommunicado, away from the Red Cross. Nobody can see them. You know, forget the people at Guantanamo for a second. Most of the main high-level terrorist suspects who were involved in September 11th, who have been captured, are not held at Guantanamo. And they're not in Afghanistan, and they're not in Baghdad. They're at secret sites somewhere in the world. Nobody really knows where most of the time. If you go on the White House website, they boast about them being held. So they went to Geneva and they tried to, you know, justify that, and the committee just threw them out on their ear, saying that's just legally unjustifiable. They also talked about Guantanamo, saying, you know, Guantanamo, the Red Cross is there and lawyers can go. It's not a tenable situation. There's been a lot of reports of abuse. The people there have no way of challenging their detention, if they're innocent, it's another problem. So that was another issue that they criticized them for.
That was John Sifton, terrorism and counterterrorism researcher with Human Rights Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. Immigration has emerged as one of the most contentious issues in U.S. politics this year. A punitive bill has passed the House of Representatives, which would criminalize undocumented workers and citizens who help them, and fund construction of a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The threat of arrest and deportation prompted millions of people to march for immigration rights in cities around the country, demanding a path to citizenship for the nation's estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants. The Senate continues to debate legislation that differs substantially from the House bill. A proposed measure would expel undocumented immigrants who have been in the U.S. less than 2 years, create a guest worker program for those here between 2 and 5 years, and provide a path to citizenship for those who have been in the country more than 5 years. But in the debate on Capitol Hill and in the media, one issue is just about never raised, except by the immigrants themselves. That is the U.S. role in creating an economic crisis in Mexico, where 75% of the undocumented immigrants in the U.S. come from. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and now a distinguished fellow there. He explains how the North American Free Trade Agreement destabilized and weakened Mexico's economy, exacerbating cross-border immigration, and why more than fences are needed to address the problem.
Before the North American Free Trade Agreement, illegal immigration from Mexico was less than half of what it is now. And if you go back 20 years, before the early 1980s, it was just a trickle. Mexico at that time was poor, but the economy was relatively stable. What happened was, as a result of the U.S. helping bailing out Mexico in the early 1980s, they had a crisis with their currency at that time. Mexico started to deregulate, to privatize, and its growth in the 1980s slowed down. And you saw illegal immigration begin to accelerate. And then with the North American Free Trade Agreement, illegal immigration really took off from Mexico. Why? A number of reasons, but the most important is that the treaty forced Mexico to open up its borders to subsidized and cheap U.S. corn and wheat from Canada as well. This meant that from 1 to 2 million Mexican farmers could no longer live on their land. They could not compete with the subsidized big agribusiness corn that was coming in from the United States. So they were driven off their land with their families and with the workers that that worked for them. These were small farmers. There were no jobs in the cities, and so they came to the United States. Risking their lives, more than 400 died last year crossing the border. So you've got to look at two sides to an immigration problem. That is, the side to which the immigrants are going and the side from which they're coming. And we're not looking at that second at all.
Jeff Foe, if we do look at it, what do you think could help solve the problem?
Well, the essential problem here is that we made an agreement, we made a treaty with Mexico, a so-called free trade agreement, that did not take into consideration what would happen to the people. So it was an agreement that allowed trade and money to flow across the border, but did not provide for the social protections that every economy has for its people. Didn't have provide for minimum wages, didn't provide for free and open union elections, it didn't provide for unemployment compensation, things of that sort. And it didn't provide for a program for Mexico that would stimulate economic growth in a way that provided jobs and raised incomes for Mexicans. During the debate over NAFTA, we were promised by both Republicans and Democrats, by the way, that Mexico would grow and illegal immigration would diminish. Instead, illegal immigration took off in Mexico. If you compare the free trade agreement that we made with Mexico with the way that the European Union organized the economic integration of Western Europe back in the 50s and 60s, you can see what I'm talking about. In Europe, when they first began this idea of integrating the markets, people in France and Germany and Holland and the richer countries were frightened at the notion that people from Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland would flood their economies with workers looking for work. So they provided, in addition to the trade and money that crossed the border, they provided help for those countries, and they required, as a condition of being in the economic, in the European Union, labor laws and laws that, you know, allowed the kind of growth that got in Portugal and Spain and places like that, allowed that growth to be shared broadly in the population. It created jobs that had decent incomes, and lo and behold, people did not move. People did not migrate from those countries. So it's an extraordinary lesson that if people have job opportunities, not job opportunities equal to the United States, but at least opportunities for people to get a job, have a decent wage, be able to support a family, people would rather stay where they are. And we hear that in the interviews with migrants. But we did not take that into consideration. What essentially we did was make a treaty with Mexico that provided benefits for the rich on both sides of the border, and the poor, especially Mexican poor workers, were the people who paid the price.
That was Jeff Foe of the Economic Policy Institute. Call EPI at area code 202-775-8810 or visit the group's website at www.epinet.org. Foe's book, Global Class War, has recently been published by John Wiley & Sons.
He's America's most censored journalist. He uncovered how George Bush stole the election in 2000 and again in 2004. Now he's ready to show you the whole armed madhouse, from stolen ballot boxes to the war on terror as profit center. KBOO 90.7 FM and the Portland Alliance brings you Greg Palast on Monday, June 5th at First Unitarian Universalist Church at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. Admission $8 to $15. Program begins at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. Hosted by Dave Mazza and includes special guest Air America's Tom Hartman. Don't miss Greg's reading from his new book, Armed Madhouse, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War. Copies on sale and signed at the program. For more information, call 503-239-4991.